Progress with Freedom Foundation here in Washington, D.C., and I want to welcome you to this afternoon's congressional seminar on the complexities of regulating TV violence. As all of you are certainly aware, on April 26th, the Federal Communications Commission released its long-awaited report on violent television programming and its effect on children. In that report, the FCC argued that the government should assume a greater role in regulating violent video programming on television. The agency concluded that such regulation would, quote, serve the government's interests in protecting the well-being of children and facilitating parental supervision and would be reasonably likely to be upheld as constitutional, end quote. As a result, Congress appears poised to act and legislation is expected to soon be introduced by Senator Jay Rockefeller and other lawmakers potentially. This legislation would open the door to federal regulation of violent television programming for both over-the-air broadcast television networks and stations, as well potentially as cable and satellite television networks and stations. Is such regulation necessary? Do parents have the tools at their disposal already to potentially handle this responsibility on their own? Or is additional government action needed to assist them? If so, how would excessively violent content be defined? And what would the impact of such rules be on artistic creativity or freedom of expression? And finally, would such rules withstand constitutional review under First Amendment scrutiny? These are just a few of the questions we hope to address and answer here today as we explore the complexities of regulating televised violence. Now, before I introduce our distinguished group of experts we've assembled here today to discuss these matters, I just want to make mention of the fact that the Progress and Freedom Foundation has just released a new report on this matter entitled The Right Way to Regulate Violent TV, which is available out here on the table as well as on our website, www.pff.org. And this report lays out 25 pages of different types of parental control tools and methods to potentially deal with this question of objectionable programming in our homes. In addition to that, we will be releasing next month a new report from which this is condensed, a booklet entitled Parental Controls and Online Child Protection, a Survey of Tools and Methods, in which I attempt to outline for all technologies and all media platforms all the various tools and methods that are out there on the market today to assist parents in this regard. So please excuse this shameless plug for my own work, but I do feel that the parental controls part of the story is obviously very important and will play a role in this debate. I'll say no more about it myself, though, today. The experts we have assembled here today instead are going to speak about much more broadly on other issues, including the legal, practical, and even scientific concerns about the current effort to regulate violent video programming. The format is very straightforward. I've asked each of our panelists to keep their opening remarks to around 8 to 10 minutes and leave plenty of time for rebuttal and discussion and then audience Q&A after that. Now let me introduce our panel. I just ask you as a courtesy to them before we start to please mute your cell phones or other portable electronic devices. First, we'll hear from Henry Geller, who was general counsel of the FCC from 1964 to 1970 and was special assistant to the chairman from 1970 to 73. Upon leaving the FCC, he was associated with the RAND Corporation and the Aspen Institute. And he also served as assistant secretary of commerce for communications and information in the Carter administration. Second, we'll hear from Bob Korn Revere, who's a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Davis Wright Tremaine, where he specializes not only in First Amendment law, but in all facets of Internet, media, and communications policy and law. Bob has argued many important cases before the courts, but he's probably most proud of the fact that he won the case of United States versus Playboy Entertainment Group, in which the United States Supreme Court struck down Section 505 of the Telecom Act of 1996 as a violation of the First Amendment. Incidentally, Bob filed comments in the proceeding on violence before the FCC on behalf of a diverse coalition of media coalitions and organizations, and these comments are available on the table as well. Third, we'll hear from Professor Jonathan Friedman, who is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto. He received a BA from Harvard and a PhD in social psychology from Yale. He's taught at Stanford University and Columbia University before moving to the University of Toronto. He has addressed the issue of the supposed link between media violence and aggression in many different articles, and most recently in this book, Media Violence and Its Effect on Aggression, Assessing the Scientific Evidence. He's also brought along a new paper that he's released for the Media Institute today, which is available out there, which condenses his findings and updates. Finally, we'll hear from Robin Bronk, the Executive Director of the Creative Coalition, a leading nonprofit nonpartisan advocacy organization in the arts and entertainment industry. She's dedicated to educating and mobilizing the arts community on issues of public importance, including First Amendment matters. Before joining the Creative Coalition in 1998, Robin served as Vice President of Corporate Community Strategies for APCO Associates, and before that worked at ABC News and has won numerous awards for her works on public affairs. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Henry Geller, and our panelists will be speaking today from their seats, and then after they're done, I'll come back up here to moderate Q&A. Henry.
Thank you. I'm going to focus on the constitutional issues. As you heard, the FCC concluded that the regime proposed would likely be held constitutional. I disagree with that for two reasons. The first one involves the difficulty of defining excessive violence. You do have to have a workable definition of what is being prohibited or channeled to laid out. The cases, the 1997 Reno case, and just to quote one other, Justice Scalia in a recent argument involving campaign reform said, this is a First Amendment case. We don't make people guess whether their speech is going to be allowed or not by Big Brother. If you're going to cut off speech, you must have a clear First Amendment line. The reason why is that if you go over the line, you can be penalized. Now the penalties in thousands of dollars. The top one, if it's continuing, is $325,000. And broadcast your renewal can be held up. There are, therefore, chilling effects here and the possibility of self-censorship to avoid these penalties. The FCC, after 3 years, did not develop any definition of their own. They made suggestions to Congress. They also said, Congress, you can do it. But it is a very difficult task. If you just look, starting point, the definition of excessive violence, it means going beyond the limit, going beyond what's proper. That's just mush. It's subjective. Oh, I'm sorry. It's going beyond what is proper, and what you end up with is a subjective judgment. It won't do. If you look at the industry definition, they use terms such as graphic or moderate or intense, and again, the line between them is just subjective. If you look at what has been used in research, there are a number of terms that have been used, extensive violence, realistic violence, justified violence, whether the perpetrator was portrayed as attractive. I go on and on about these context issues. But again, you end up not knowing whether you can do something or not. You could get a definition that said if you kill anybody or try to injure them, but then you would have much too much. You would be covering everything from Hamlet on. You could try to describe, let's say, a slasher movie, Texas Chainsaw. But if you just did that and just eliminated that, you would have covered very little of what you're trying to do here. Judge Harry Edwards wrote a law review on this, and he concluded that it can't be done, that either what you're trying to do, the definition is overbroad or vague, or it's so specific that it just doesn't do the job at all. If you look at what has been done in the indecency channeling, it has its problems. That's shown by pending appeal. But that's going to be a pleasant picnic in implementation compared to what would happen if you went on to violence. There aren't the same number. When you look at the number of complaints in indecency, it doesn't even begin to what you would get in violence, because violent programming is really pervasive. As Commissioner Edelstein said in his statement, we are in a sea of violence. he showed, if you look just at the schedule of the networks from 8 to 10 p.m., their violent programming, very common in that time setting. And what the conclusion, the only conclusion you come to, is that if you try to implement that program in excessive violence, you would end up with a horrendous problem. It would be horrendous for the industry. It would be for the regulators. It would be for the adults, their First Amendment right, and for children, because children have First Amendment rights also. The second block here involves the reasonable alternative. If you are doing content regulation, the jurisprudence says that it must be for a compelling governmental purpose, narrowly tailored to that purpose, and it must be the least restrictive way of doing it, of accomplishing that purpose. If there is an alternative that avoids the regulation, it must be taken. Well, I'm going to address this first in terms of cable, and that's fair enough because 86% of TV viewers now watch through cable or through satellite, the subscription satellite. And the first thing to note here is that cable does not come within the jurisprudence of broadcast that the Supreme Court has fashioned. In the broadcast field, the government is allowed much more leeway to fashion regulations, including in the content area. It's a case called Red Lion that most of you may be familiar with. The government tried to extend that to cable, and in the 1994 case Turner, the Supreme Court said, no, you cannot do that. So cable and subscription satellite come under the traditional jurisprudence, which means that if there is this alternative, it must be taken. And in the case that Adam referred to already, the Playboy case of that Bob won, the Supreme Court held that in dealing with what was largely a channeling requirement, it was beyond hours when children would not be in the audience or would be only a small number, it invalidated that. It did so because it said you have an alternative. Under the Act, a cable subscriber can turn to the cable company and say, I don't want that channel, and it will be taken off. It's quoted in Adam's paper, but I want to read what the court said because it goes to some of the arguments made here. It is no response that voluntary blocking requires a consumer to take action or may be inconvenient or may not go perfectly every time. A court should not assume a plausible, less restrictive alternative would be ineffective. And a court should not presume that parents given full information will fail to act. In Reno also referred to the fact that when you are on the internet, you have software available that the parent can program. There are references in the court opinion to the V-chip, and there were references to the fact that cable is going digital, and when it goes digital, it has set-top boxes which can be readily programmed. So you have all these alternatives available. And the crucial point I want to make here is that everything is going digital. If you look ahead, it's all going to be the internet probably in 10 years. But if you look even at broadcast, in a year and a half, which is not a long time, broadcasting will be doing digital, February 2009. When it does digital, you can have a chip easily. It's trivial expense in there that does the V-chip, and you make an enhanced V-chip that allows you to program. The cost would be very small. The government could even compel it if the manufacturer didn't add it just as a plus. And result of that, you would have a software solution here, just as you have in Reno. Is the result of all this is that what has to be done here is to take these tools, make them fully available to inform the parent of what is available, how it's to be used. The government should nudge in this area using maybe the Department of Education. They could use all kinds of resources that have been mentioned in the papers. Could use PTAs and subsidize their action. But the point is to put the parent in a position to make the very difficult judgments that have to be made here, and only they can make. You can take anything you want to History Channel. You can't, at some point it might be full of war and terrible violence, and another point it might be very educational. Only the parent can exercise a judgment that would make that division. The final point I would make is that the cases that I'm relying upon are recent cases. They're all within the last 10 years. Every justice who participated in the majority opinion in Playboy and in the Reno case are still on the court. I think that the FCC does a disservice when it puts out a notice, discusses these issues, including constitutionality, and does not confront cases that are directly in point.
Thank you, Danny. Very good. Bob Korn Rivera.
Thanks, Adam, and thanks for coming, and welcome to the Gray Hair Club for Men. Actually, apologies to Robin and Adam. And Adam, don't worry, you'll get there. I'm going to talk a little bit about the FCC violence report itself and whether or not it provides a sound basis for policymaking. And I have to say, it's a little daunting following Henry Geller, because if there is a source of institutional knowledge for communications law in Washington, it's Henry Geller. So I'm personally thrilled that he agreed to be on this panel. Now, as Adam mentioned, I did file comments in the FCC's notice on behalf of a number of clients, and I just want to make clear that I'm speaking for myself today. I'm not representing any clients in being part of this panel. I will say it's a little bit like going to the Penn and Teller show, though, where Penn will sometimes complain that you know, he doesn't get sympathy where Teller does when they do dangerous things on stage, because his character that he plays on stage is sort of an abusive bully, unlike Teller, who gets the sympathy. And so when I represent clients and take strong First Amendment positions, even when I'm not speaking for them, the positions that I take are really awfully close to the ones that I believe in anyway. And as part of that, too, I did teach a First Amendment seminar at Catholic University for about 13 years. So a lot of what I have to say comes from that. In terms of the FCC's violence report, however, I think the best thing that people can do if they want to evaluate whether or not it's a sound basis for policymaking is to first read the 2004 notice of inquiry and then immediately afterward read the 2007 report. And I think it will be striking the extent to which the final report failed to answer any of the essential questions that were raised in the 2004 inquiry. Let me just mention three of them by way of overview. For example, the 2004 notice asks, what are the effects of viewing violent programming on children and other segments of the population? It cited the 2001 Surgeon General's report on youth violence and asked for any additional recent research in the field, and said that there are a number of questions that are not answered, and asked for guidance on whether watching Wile E. Coyote fall off a cliff in a cartoon has more or less impact on a child's psyche than reading about Hansel and Gretel forcing a witch into a hot oven in Grimm's Fairy Tales. That was the question that it laid out. In 2007, the FCC acknowledged that very little new information on the issue was submitted into the record of this proceeding, but then went on to say, but we agree with the 2001 Surgeon General's report, which of course was the starting point for the FCC's questions. So essentially what the commission did was convert the questions that it raised in 2004 into conclusions in 2007, and then added at the end of the report that it was on that basis it would recommend congressional action. Secondly, it asked whether, again, particular portrayals of violence are more likely to cause deleterious effects than others, what specific kinds of programming should be the focus of any further public policymaking in this area. It asked whether or not public policymaking should address all violence or just excessive and gratuitous violence, and how should that be defined. Of course, as Henry has already mentioned, the commission in its 2007 report didn't come up with a definition of violence. It said instead that, quote, developing a definition would be challenging, and it concluded only that, quote, we believe Congress could do so, unquote. So again, the essential question that the commission raised in 2004 was ducked in the 2007 report. And then finally, and there are other questions, but I'm just focusing on these three, the commission in 2004 asked, are there legal constraints on either Congress or the commission to regulate violent programming? And said, given the definitional issues discussed above, how could Congress or the commission define some form of violent programming in a way that is not unconstitutionally vague or overbroad? The commission had a really scant discussion of the legal issues and then simply concluded, we believe that developing an appropriate definition of excessively violent programming would be possible, but that such language needs to be narrowly tailored and in conformance with judicial precedent. Now, I'm unclear from reading the report what precedent the commission had in mind, since it discussed none of the recent cases that have expressly dealt with the issue of violence in media. Let me focus, based on those overview points, I think what is the heart of the commission's report, and that is whether or not it is possible to come up with a definition of violence. Now, that's not just a narrow legal issue. It's not just a question of whether or not some definition of violence would be unconstitutionally vague or would lack due process or would be difficult to fashion as a matter of legislative policy. This is really a question that goes to the heart of all of the issues that are debated as part of what to do with media violence. For example, defining what you're trying to study is necessary for social scientists to determine the phenomenon that they would have policymakers then regulate. It's necessary for policymakers to understand what kinds of programming they want to restrict. And it's also important to see how those two issues overlap, how the social science works with the law. And then, of course, you have to pass constitutional muster. What the FCC did instead was say it's possible to come up with a definition of violence, and we think that it should be done as a matter of context. You have to look at the context of violence and base that contextual analysis on what various researchers have said. Now, that's all well and good, except none of the researchers have agreed on what kind of violence is problematic. Many of them use different indices of violence, and so even determining what you're going to study and how that applies to the law is a very difficult enterprise. For example, the UCLA television violence report observed that many feel that violent spectator sports, such as football or hockey, make violence an acceptable or even desirable part of American life. As a consequence, it included sports violence in its definition of televised violence. Some researchers, like Joanne Cantor, have said that news is another source of violence that can be disturbing to children, and that that should be included as well. There has also been testimony before the FCC in 2000 that there is similarly the same kind of impact, the same kind of psychological impact from programs such as Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan. So even though there is an appeal to, you know, just trying to go after the bad violence, it's not clear that that links up to the problem that policymakers would seek to solve, and that is the effect on children. In that regard, the commission's report said that it would exempt news programs from the definition of violence to be regulated, but it's not clear that that is consistent with what the researchers are saying. Some researchers suggest that, as I mentioned, news violence may be problematic as well. So there's no indication that any regulations, if they were adopted, would have any impact at all on the problem that's been identified. In that regard, unless you have a working definition of violence, you don't even know what you're counting when you're trying to argue one way or the other that violence has either increased or decreased in media portrayals. And by the way, I should be clear, when I say violence in the media, unless you're talking about sports, you're not talking about actual violence, you're talking about pictures of violence. And so, again, you have to determine what representations of violence you're going to include. One of the most recent and well-publicized examples of that was the Parents Television Council's report, Dying to Entertain, which was their follow-up on the 2003 report called Creatively TV Bloodbath. And the most recent report suggested that the amount of violence in prime time has increased 75%, an alarming 75%, since their last report in 2003. Now, the problem is that the definition of what's considered violent has shifted between 2003 and 2007. And in its report, although it doesn't provide its methodology, it says categories of violence tracked by PTC analysts included person-on-person violence, self-inflicted violence, such as suicide, medical violence, gory autopsies, for example, and general mayhem, including explosions, car crashes, and the like. And it goes on to say that even if you have something that deals with the aftermath of violence, like discovering a dead body, I guess you can presume that violence happened in the scene, so you'll count that too. Now, the problem with that is that that category of medical violence wasn't included in the 2003 report, and in the 2007 report, it suggests that ER is the second most violent series on television, and 91% of the violence in the program was categorized as medical violence, and the remaining 9% was general mayhem. So unless you have a working definition of violence, you can't even count what programs you're going to study, let alone determine what their effect is, or what law or policy should be fashioned in response to them. That brings us to the legal questions, and Henry, I think, has done a great job of indicating that there are massive legal hurdles to overcome. As a point of fact, no court has ever upheld restrictions of this type, even though attempts to regulate violence in various forms go back to the 1940s, and I'm sure before that. But the first Supreme Court case to address it was in 1948, striking down a restriction on the publication of stories involving celebrations of blood, bloodshed and lust and general violence. Henry mentioned the path-breaking article by Judge Harry Edwards, which I think is must-reading for anyone who really wants to look at this area. And I think the bottom line is this. Judge Edwards described trying to regulate this in this area as a jurisprudential quagmire. And I think we're all too familiar with quagmires these days. But he adds, with his co-author, when it comes to televised violence, we cannot imagine how regulators can distinguish between harmless and harmful violent speech, and we can find no proposal that overcomes the lack of supporting data. There have been numerous courts that have looked at this issue, including the Eighth Circuit in Missouri in the mid-90s, when it struck down a regulation that would have required the segregation of violent videos, including slasher videos that Henry had mentioned. In Tennessee, the Tennessee Supreme Court struck down a similar law relating to violent literature being distributed. And this was all before, these cases were all out there before the FCC's report. In fact, the new area that has the greatest source of litigation in this area involving the regulation of violent video games, two circuits and one district court had already struck down restrictions before the FCC's report was issued in 2004. Since then, another five district courts have issued opinions striking down various state laws. So the count now is, in addition to the Indianapolis ordinance, regulations of violent video games have been struck down in Illinois, Missouri, Michigan, Minnesota, California, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Washington. And it's getting to the point that judges, I think, are beginning to lose patience with the various state regulators who are well aware of the cases that have been decided. In one of the more recent cases striking down the Minnesota law, Judge Rosenbaum wrote, "The court will not speculate as to the motives of those who launched Minnesota's nearly doomed effort to protect our children. Who, after all, opposes protecting children? But the legislators drafting this law cannot have been blind to its constitutional flaws." So I think the FCC's report, in not discussing the relevant case law and in simply trying to assume it could extend existing broadcast jurisprudence to this area, really failed to answer the questions and, for the same reason as Judge Rosenbaum identified, could not have been blind to the serious constitutional flaws. Now, the last thing I'd like to talk about is some of the proposed, include the proposed solutions that are laid out in the report, and they include what are called time channeling, or we sometimes refer to it as the safe harbor, which prohibits the broadcasting of whatever the proscribed content is between certain hours. So between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m., for example, is the time channeling solution for broadcast indecency. That is one of the types of proposals that is endorsed by the 2007 report on violence. And it also talks about a la carte distribution of multi-channel videos. Cable would be able to sell you channels one at a time, for example. I think the solutions are not only indefensible legally, and they certainly are indefensible legally, but they're simply irrelevant. You know, I think, if nothing else, the proposed solutions are sort of a tribute to André Maginot, who, as you may remember, was the Minister of Defense in France from 1928 to 1931. He convinced his government to build a line of gun emplacements and bunkers from on the German border, stretching from Switzerland to Luxembourg, and took a 10-year project, built all of these bunkers, and then when the Germans invaded in World War II, they simply drove their tanks around the line, and it became known as the Maginot Line. It has become synonymous with amusingly futile solutions to things. Now, of course, the fact that the Germans were able to bypass it in World War II is bad news. The good news, I suppose, with homegoers is you've got those great images of the Nazis marching into Paris during Casablanca. But, you know, that's really not very helpful when you're trying to actually solve the problem. But time channeling in this regard, saying that you're going to require time channeling for broadcasting, is a bit like an electronic Maginot Line. You know, we live in a world in which people watching television at the time it's broadcast is an increasingly realistic phenomenon. In the age of TiVo, even in the age of VCRs, it isn't a solution to say you're simply going to make the program appear later in the evening if that means that people will simply watch it when they've taped it or recorded it on a digital video recorder and they watch it later. And that's true increasingly of all media. It's increasingly personal, whether it's video, iPods, wireless distribution through phones, direct downloads on your computer. I mean, you can essentially watch anything you want when you want it. And so to suggest that you're going to protect children, who are the larger consumers of personalized media, by time-shifting the program strikes me as being just fanciful. The next proposed solution is a la carte, requiring the sale of channels on a separate basis. And I won't say much about that except to say that there's no justification whatsoever in the FCC's report for regulating cable television or other multi-channel media. The entire justification is based on broadcast precedents. So to say that you're going to regulate cable based on the analysis in the report really doesn't even begin to complete the analysis. But the other thing that's really strange about the a la carte solution is that under the 1992 Cable Act, cable operators are required by law to make sure that all subscribers get all of the broadcast channels. So that if the policy concern that the FCC identified was that broadcast television includes images of violence that need to be regulated, and the law already requires people to get all of those channels anyway, then a la carte really does nothing to address that issue. Again, finally, the FCC says that news is exempt, but again, if the research, speaking of their solutions, if the research indicates that that is the source of the problem, again, it's hard to tell what it's really going to accomplish. And then finally, if policymakers are looking for some kind of guidance and a more comprehensive analysis of both the social science data and the law, I'd recommend the 6 Federal Trade Commission reports that have been issued since the year 2000. They total something like 800 pages. Many of them, particularly the 2000 report and the 2007 report, which just came out in April, contain analyses of the law, including the more recent video game cases and their application. The 2000 report includes an extensive analysis of the social science research that Jonathan may care to discuss. So overall, if Congress or policymakers are looking for an indication of what direction to go with this, then there is an independent agency that has provided the comprehensive analysis, and I think it provides a much better basis for making a decision than the FCC's report.
Thank you, Bob. Professor Friedman.
Thank you very much. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a psychologist, and I'm going to talk about the research, not the legal aspects of it. So I want to start by just pointing out that of the 3 reports, and I guess there are many more, but in this century, there have been 3 government reports that talk about the effect of television violence. The Surgeon General's report concluded that there was a short-term minor effect on aggression, but that there was no effect on violence or criminal violence, and it was simply not a risk factor. The FTC doubted that there was even any effect on aggression. And the FCC, although it's the strongest of them, says in a sort of oddly worded sentence, on balance, there is strong evidence, if that makes any sense to you, that there is a short-term effect on aggression. Again, ignoring the whole question of violence or criminal violence. So I would have thought, I'm not a lawyer, but I would have thought that any attempt to limit access to television or limit to anything that might infringe on the First Amendment, you would have to have a very strong case for it and very sort of overriding purpose. And here what we're talking about is a short-term effect at most, and I'll tell you in a second I don't agree with this, but at most a short-term effect on minor aggression, whatever that means. It's hardly a reason to turn the world upside down and start dealing with whether you can control children's access to television, which is probably impossible even if you pass the law. Now, let me talk about what the actual research shows. There are people, a group of people, and I'm sad to say they're mostly psychologists, who are absolutely convinced that the research, I guess they're convinced anyway, they keep saying that the research shows that exposure to television violence causes people to be aggressive, to be violent, and as a cause for violent crime. They say this over and over again. I just recently saw an interview I had, and I was trying to copy some of my old VCRs onto DVDs, and I saw an old interview I had with Leonard Eron, who's one of the great figures in this research. Father, 1983 or 4, he says exactly the same thing. There's overwhelming evidence. The case is closed. Exactly why they continue doing the research is not clear, but then the case was closed. But it's important to understand that none of these three agencies, although they all have some different points of view, not the Surgeon General, not the FTC, and certainly not, and not the FTC and not the FCC, say the case is overwhelming, the case is closed. On balance is what the FCC says, and the FTC doesn't even accept the on balance. So not overwhelming. So what does it show? And this is really what we come down to. I've read all of the research. There are over 200 articles on this. I published a book on it. And reading all the evidence, it is very clear that despite what they say, it does not produce a strong case for believing that exposure to television violence causes aggression, much less violence. There's never any hint that it affects violence, but even aggression. Some of this research is very good. People say, well, it's lousy research. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that. Some of it is very good research. Some of it's not so good research. Some of it can be criticized, and I've criticized it. But taking it all at face value, ignoring all of the criticism, if you simply look at the findings, every line of research, and there's experimental research, and there's correlational research, and there's survey research, and all different kinds, every line of research has failed to produce even a simple majority of studies that show this effect. In fact, most of the lines of research overwhelmingly, I hate to use their word, but overwhelmingly show that there is no effect on aggression. So that's one point. And then the thing is that every once in a while they do get an effect. But when the effect, then the question comes, and this is Bob's point, only it's the other end of it, how do you define aggression? And how do you define violence is very difficult. But how do you define aggression? Well, it's very difficult to study aggression. But listen to some of the things that have been done. One of the cutest studies is, this is the experimenter says to a 5-year-old boy, if I had a balloon, would you pop it? The double hypothetical. And if the boy says yes, that's aggression. Believe this? These are serious people, supposedly. Then there's a whole line of studies that use Bobo dolls. Maybe some of you don't know what a Bobo doll is, but it's an inflatable plastic doll. And it looks like a clown, has a big nose usually. And if you hit the nose, the doll is weighted so that it goes down and then it pops back up. Hitting the Bobo doll on the nose is a sign of aggression. And that's used as a measure of aggression. Now, that's what bobo dolls are for. They are designed to be hit. You know? It's like saying kicking a football is aggression. Footballs are meant to be kicked. Soccer balls are meant to be kicked. Kicking a soccer ball is not aggression. Punching a bobo doll is not aggression. In fact, I've sometimes suggested that not punching a bobo doll is aggression because they expect to be punched, you know, letting them fulfill their role in life. Sometimes they've used something a little better. People can set a noise, and how loud the noise is an indication of being aggressive. A hypothetical person in the other room is going to hear this noise. But the noise is never louder than what my son, and probably if you have any teenagers, listen to voluntarily all the time, because you can't make it any louder than that, because it might really damage their eardrums. So but anyway, a loud noise isn't normally what we think of as an aggressive act. There are a few studies, almost only with children, where they look at actual behavior in a playground, for example. And almost all of those fail to find anything. And that, you know, do they really punch and kick and get into fights? Almost never. And it's not easy research to do because kids play around. You know, boys always are fighting. How can you tell whether they're fighting really or just playing around? Keep in mind that there is a strong bias against publishing studies that don't get an effect. This is true in all of science. It's certainly true in my field. We like to see effects. Doing a study and not getting effects, well, that's pretty boring. And it could be due to your incompetence. It could be due to that you didn't do it right. So there's a very strong bias to publish studies that get an effect. And there's a very strong bias in favor of those things that sound right. Well, that television violence causes aggression sounds right for an awful lot of people, including psychologists. So there's a bias against publishing these so-called negative results. And yet, by far the majority of the published studies get negative results, despite the bias. So I think it's very clear that to me, that the research doesn't support it. And I wrote this book, I submitted a report to the FCC, and what I call the other people who are very strong advocates of the other position, I call them the true believers, because they have a sort of religious zeal about them. And the true believers could have looked at my book and said, well, we don't agree with that, and here's why. Page 60 makes an error. Page 80 makes an error. Page 10, when he talks about one of our favorite studies, he gets it wrong. They could have gone through it and pointed out all the errors I made. I probably made some errors. I don't know. I tried not to. But they could have pointed this out. They didn't do that. I also submitted, with Bob, a fairly long submission to the FCC. They sort of mention it in passing. The FCC never says, well, we rejected that because on page whatever it was, 12, we don't agree when he said blah, blah, blah. No line by line or page by page or study by study criticism. But that's what science is about. You don't just say, I don't like it. I don't agree with it. You have to find the errors. You can't just say it's biased. You think it's biased? Show that it's biased. You can't just say, well, he spends too much time on the studies he likes and not enough time on the studies we like. You have to show that that happened. So I think this is sort of no think. I mean, they're not paying attention to the arguments. Now, everyone has a problem with this because this is a sort of he said, he said kind of situation. So I say to you, the research doesn't show it, doesn't show an effect. And they say over and over and over again, the research is overwhelming, the case is closed. And I assume that most of you, it's probably fair to say, all of you, none of you, have read all of the research. I mean, I don't recommend it. It is not fun reading. Although some of them are hilarious, but I mean, it's not, you know, bursting the bubble, the balloon is nice. But most of it is pretty tedious. And so you're asked, and the FCC was asked, and Congress is asked, take somebody's word for it. And whose word do you take? It's not easy. And that's a problem, and it really is a problem. So I'm not suggesting that anyone should go back and read all of the studies, although you might pick a few and read the ones that are controversial. But I'll make an offer. I know Senator Rockefeller is apparently going to submit a bill. Now, I happen to have been in college with Senator Rockefeller for a couple of years, and I know that Jay was then a very intelligent, very sincere, very honest person. And I suspect, I don't know him, haven't seen him in a long time, that he's the same now, that he sincerely believes that television violence is harmful. But he's basing that, again, I assume he hasn't had the time, and probably even his staff hasn't had the time to read it all, maybe not the training. So he's basing it on the people who talk the loudest or the people that sound right. So I make an offer to Jay Rockefeller or to any other congressperson, congressman, or congresswoman who has an open mind about this. Pick 5 or 10 of the studies that you think or you are told produce the strongest evidence that television violence is harmful. Pick 5 or 10 of them. And I'll spend some time with you. And I really think I can convince you there are no 10 studies, there are no 5 studies that produce convincing evidence. If you pick 5 or 10, we'll go over just those 5 or 10. I really think I can convince you. Okay, I probably can't, but I would give it a try. Now, I just want to close with one final thing. When we have an effect that we have studied in the science of laboratory, and we've studied it in laboratories, and we've studied it with various kinds of techniques, but typically, as in this case, it's based on relatively small number of people who have been studied. You know, some of the bigger studies have a few hundred, maybe even 500 or 600. Some of them have 10, as few as 10. Altogether, thousands, not tens of thousands. It's not a big group of people. That's the way science works, at least this kind of science. But you should be able to see an effect in the real world. I'm a scientist, and I've spent my life mostly studying research in the laboratory, but I like to see effects in the real world. Then I start really believing them. So what should we expect? And I'll just very briefly, when we say lung cancer is caused by smoking cigarettes, we look in the real world and we say, well, people who smoke are more likely to get lung cancer. Well, that's obvious that we should get that. But there are all sorts of reasons why that might be. It could be lifestyle. It could be something else. But there's a better thing. In the early part of the 20th century, it was improper or thought to be improper for women to smoke in the United States. Very few women smoked. Lots of men smoked. We should expect that there would be higher rates of lung cancer among men than among women during that period and following it. There were. Then things changed and women were allowed to smoke. And women started smoking in greater and greater numbers, and so they smoke as many of them smoke as men. We should expect lung cancer rates among women to go up and to be equal to men. They did. That's good. That makes us very confident, if we weren't already, but very confident that in the real world, smoking causes lung cancer. Now, in television violence, television was introduced in the United States. It got broadly, it was in most of the houses by about 1955. Seems like a long time ago, but anyway. So if television violence and television causes violence and causes aggression, you should see an increase in violent crime sometime after that. It takes a while to happen. Well, we did. There was a tremendous increase in violent crime between 1965 and 1980. It was awful. I lived through it in New York City in the 70s. Ugh, not nice. And it was a very bad thing. Well, people blamed it on television. They could have blamed it on toaster ovens or microwaves. They were coming in. And they could have blamed it on realistic things like the police tend to blame it on crack cocaine. And other people, sociologists, blamed it on unwanted children. And the sexual revolution was caused that. All sorts of complicated factors. We don't know what caused it. Lots of reasons. Okay, so television got the bad rap. Fine. Well, crime rate leveled off until about 1990. And in 1990, we had just as much violence on television, maybe more. We had just as much violence in the movies, and more lurid and realistic. We had rap music with all of its violent lyrics. And we had the beginning of the enormous growth in violent video games, so that virtually every male child and many male adults were playing violent video games. the true believers not only believe that television violence is harmful, but that all the media violence is harmful. There's no reason to, as far as they're concerned, there's no reason to distinguish among them. It's all harmful. And they predicted, and they should have predicted, that starting around 1990, crime rates, violent crime rates, would go through the roof. After all, we have all this violent media. And as you probably know, what happened is starting around 1992, crime rates in the United States fell off the roof, dropped like a stone, and dropped for the next 12, 15 years, so that now rates of violent crime are below what they were before television was introduced into the United States. They hate to hear this, the true believers, because they like the other story. It went up because of television. They hate the story, and they don't come to grips with it. They could probably come up with some explanation, but they don't like to hear that. So I just say to them, to the government, to the members of Congress, why do you want to restrict access to violent television now when crime rates are lower than they were when you were growing up?
Okay. Friedman, Robin Brown.
Hi. Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I am not a gray-haired man. Nor have I written a book on the issue, and I haven't read everything on the issue. But what I am is the executive director of the Creative Coalition, as Adam mentioned. And for almost 20 years, the Creative Coalition, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public advocacy arm of the arts and entertainment community, has taken on this issue of protecting First Amendment and creative freedoms. And what I wanted to do is start off by paraphrasing something the First Amendment Center put together recently with the help of Wired Magazine. Humans, us, have been grappling for centuries with fears that technology, and especially technology coupled with popular culture, will be the demise of society. For example, in 1790, a renowned reverend said, "Romance novels and plays poison the mind and corrupt the morals of many a promising youth." In 1909, the New York Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children said, "Movies have gone far to blast maidenhood." The Knights of Columbus worried that the telephone would surely break up home life. Clearly they didn't think about one of these. And all children who are drug addicts were inveterate comic book readers, said Frederick Wertheim in 1954. And of course we all know that rock and roll turns young people into devil worshippers, sex fiends, and mental wrecks. So that being said, here we are today, in a world where our children have an infinite amount of media available to them, an infinite amount of technology available to them. And everyone under 12 does know how to use this technology, and it is natural for them to use the technology. So what do? We have a generation of children who have this access but aren't literate in it. And we also have a government that wants to step in because many feel that something has to be done, that we don't have appropriate guidelines for our children, for our families, and specifically in television viewing. And if you look historically, the government has stepped in places where they feel like the American family needs guidance. It's the FDA who created the food pyramid, who gives us nutrition labels. There's the SEC who monitors banking. But at the end of the day, the government is not taking those potato chips off of our table. They're not telling us we can't eat the potato chips. And granted, we also have this obese generation of children who are watching TV, but that's probably another issue. But what the Creative Coalition is saying, what we hope that will be embraced by the government, is that there is a need for media literacy. Just as when the Gutenberg press was developed, the literacy rate rose all across America through all classes of the citizenry. Now we have these technology tools that make media available, but our children don't know how to read it. They don't know the difference between an infomercial and the news, between product placement and a sitcom. What is a laugh track? They just don't know, and they have this medium of television available and everything from their telephones to their computers to the television sets in the family living room. And what we are saying is that we are asking the government to step in by funding programs that will provide literacy, media literacy, for children, to provide guidelines on how to teach media literacy, to get into for local governments and state governments who do control the curricula of our school to get involved, because we do have this generation of children that does need guidance. As parents, I would venture to say that, does anyone here know how VTIP works? Or can work with VTIP? Couple people, but certainly not the majority of us. We need to be educated. There are tools out there, and these tools of resources can be improved. There are guidelines out there. Some, in many surveys, say that the guidelines do work. Some say they don't understand it. Some are calling for more guidelines to be specific about the violence. How many decapitations are there? But what needs to be done is for consumers to urge the entertainment industry to put in, if better guidelines are needed, then be a consumer. Be an active consumer. Get involved. It is your right as a consumer to buy a product, to watch a product. It is not the right of the government to get into the lives in the living room of its citizens to turn off the remote control. That is our privilege, and that is something that we should not give up.
I'm going to actually throw out just one or two things to get the debate started, discussion started, and I wanted to ask specifically a question of Professor Friedman, because I find this discussion interesting about the definition of violence, the definition of aggression. There's a lot of questions about defining things properly in this debate. And this definition of aggression, and because the science is driving the policy now, this is seemingly a very important question about how do you define these things, specifically aggression. I wanted to ask you to comment on that question, respond to that a little bit more, and talk about how it's defined in the research, because I was discussing this study with you just yesterday that I found Iowa State about media exposure, aggression, and pro-social behavior during childhood, and it introduced me to this new category of, quote-unquote, relational aggression, which is, quote, in which a relationship serves as a vehicle of harm is documented when malicious secrets, lies, or gossip are transmitted, as well as intentional shunning, ignoring, or excluding or ostracizing a peer from an activity, game, or interaction. Well, you know, my son and daughter are engaged in relational aggression on a minute-by-minute basis in my home. And I don't think they're going to grow up to be mass murderers, but I mean, you know, there's this question about how we define these things, and yet the conclusion of this study is that because they see, quote-unquote, relational aggression in the subjects of the study, that they conclude that certain educational programs, such as PBS's Arthur and ABC's One Saturday Morning, quote, suggest that relational aggression is modeled at a fairly high rate, because they say kids only see in media and in entertainment certain negative themes, like a peer being shunned or ostracized or gossiping, and they only take the bad lessons, that, and then it turns into relational aggression. Bingo, there's a relationship between media aggression and... So talk us through that. I mean, is that common, or is this a unique study?
Well, that is a unique study, I think. But it's very difficult to measure aggression when you do a scientific study. Because I think at the extremes, we can tell... aggression. I'm not saying we can tell it legally, but we can tell it more or less, and science can put up with some fuzzy borders. So if somebody goes out and punches someone in the face without any provocation, we would count that as an aggressive act, and we wouldn't worry too much about whether that was an aggressive act or not. But you can't allow that kind of stuff when you're observing children. You can't let them harm each other. You can't let them hurt each other. You can't let them get involved in serious fights. And if you look at adults, they aren't going to do it, because although adults can be very aggressive, they're not going to be that way when somebody is watching, typically, unless they're a little crazy. So it is very hard to study this. And I'm not saying it's easy, but then, you know, no one ever said science was easy. But the fact is that what people do is they throw in whatever they feel like throwing in, whether it's a Bobo doll or relational aggression or anything else that they make up. There's no standard. There's no good ways of looking at it. And it's a real mess. Just like, as Bob says, the definition of violence from a legal point of view is a mess. And almost, I think the definition of violence legally is worse than the measure of aggression, but both very, very difficult. But the thing is that if you're going to pass any legislation or try to pass any legislation, as I said earlier, you better be pretty sure what the research shows. And if the worst it shows is that after watching a violent video, a violent television program, you're more likely to punch a Bobo doll, I don't think we want to pass legislation. If after watching a violent movie, you go out and you beat up your best friend or your worst enemy or something, and you're more likely to do that, that's serious. But we don't get that. We never see anything like that. There is no increase in that kind of violence. And so, I mean, the definitional, the measure of aggression is really crucial, and it trivializes. Many of these effects are trivialized because the measures are so far from what we would consider aggressive acts.
Well, let me ask either you or Bob to comment on it. I mean, both of you have just had debates and discussions with folks from various medical associations, AMA, American Psychological Association, and others. I mean, what is driving this? What do they say, I mean, when you challenge them on these things, either of you? Because, Bob, I know you've debated some of them before as well, so you can feel free to chime in here.
Well, I really don't want to speak for other groups, particularly those that take a different position, but there are on the public record quotes that you'll find, and some of them are cited in the comments that we have at the back of the room, where when asked, those from the American Medical Association said that they signed on to the joint agreement for supporting the statement that media violence leads to actual violence because it was a political compromise. And again, I'm not trying to talk about anybody's motives or anything else, but this has become a politicized issue. People take positions for a lot of different reasons. And I would just second what Jonathan said earlier, that if you really are serious about looking at the research and what it means, you really need to look at the research itself rather than what anyone has said about it, whether as part of an organized group for some part of the coalition or anything else.
Mm-hmm. Bob or Henry, a question either of you can answer. I mean, there is currently court activity pending right now on the indecency front, challenging the FCC's authority or the scope of its regulatory authority on that front in the Second and Third Circuits. Mm-hmm. And Bob's been active in this, and I don't know how much you can comment, but Henry, you have filed amicus briefs in both those circuits along with former FCC Commissioner Glenn Robinson. And we still haven't heard a decision out of the Second Circuit, although they've had oral arguments, but the Third Circuit's coming. Do you have any comments on how that might affect this debate? Because it seems like that might be important.
I think it is important because it shows how you begin small, but under political pressure from Congress, it just takes off. The Pacifica decision in 438 U.S., said that indecency complaints will be rare, they thought, and that the commission will proceed cautiously, as it has in the past. One chairman thought that they would be as rare as Halley's Comet. It turned out that they're not rare at all anymore. Congress struck, and even though I think the chairman Powell had some aversion. He had strong First Amendment beliefs. He gave into it, and the present commission has really given into it. The test in this field was it patently offensive because it described excretory or sexual activities in a manner that was patently offensive by contemporary local. It has now gone way beyond that. If you use the S word or the F word, it is a violation, even though the use of those words don't have any current meaning and are not sexual activities and are not expiratory. When somebody uses the X word, S word, and says that's what you are, he's not describing what your expiratory functions are. He just thinks you're in vulgar taste, in a vulgar, tasteless way. You can deplore it, but what it has now become kind of Comstockery. They're going through it, penalizing, and as I say, the penalties can be very large. They have drifted away entirely from the original one that we are just going to do this rarely in a few egregious cases. We're going to try to deal with the shock jockeys like Howard Stern, who went out of their way to do this type of thing. And it went on a Jazz Blue PBS show just because jazz musicians use the S word occasionally or the other. They enter the fine. I think it makes no sense, and we're hoping the court will rein it in, really rein it in. But it does show what Bob was just saying. When you get political pressure, they respond to it by going all out in these campaigns. There's one other thing. All these indecent programming, certainly excessive violence, they all have First Amendment protection. They can have a lot of redeeming value. And yet, when in Act Two, it's so-called, Action for Children's Television, the second case, what happened was that Congress banned them entirely. There was no safe harbor, 10 to 6. They just got rid of them. Dingell was then chairman of the Commerce Committee, and he said, this is absurd. We know they have First Amendment protection. You're voting for this, and you know what's going to happen. The courts are going to overturn it in a flash. But none of you want to be up for re-election and be told that you voted for indecency. And so they passed it, even though they knew they were just doing a worthless act. That's it. And I think that that why you need the First Amendment, why you need the courts to develop this strict scrutiny, least alternative, all these other things that sound so technical, you need it because you are dealing with speech. The First Amendment is the crown jewel of America, I think, and that if you don't have that kind of protection using strict scrutiny and least the alternative method that has to be taken if it will avoid the governmental regulation. If you don't have these as bulwarks, you'll get the political pressure. It'll be out there, and it will not serve the Commonwealth at all.
Sure, we're going to go to some questions unless Robin has anything you want to add before I go. Okay. Please wait till the microphone comes to you. Clearly identify yourself and have a question ready. We'll take just 1 second. We'll go up here first. The mic will come to you. Please, again, state your name and affiliation, please.
My name is Mark Nadel. I'm just speaking for myself. I have a question for Jonathan. I appreciate your frustration with getting your research rejected without being any explanation of what's wrong with the analysis. Certainly a conclusory statement isn't going to convince you or convince anybody that what you said was wrong. By the same token, though, intuitively, I have the belief that my four-year-old mimics things that he sees, and that if he sees violence on television, I would think that he would be more inclined to mimic that. Can you help me understand why that's not true? Not that the I accept that the data shows it's not true, but it's hard to accept that without an explanation to help me overcome that intuition.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think most people start with the intuition that you do. I can't tell you in any definitive way because I don't know. But one of the points that those who believe in this often make is that people watch violence on television and they learn to behave that way because they say, well, that's what other people do. and they see it being rewarded, and they see other people behaving violently, and so that's what they do. Well, the alternative way of looking at it is, in almost all programs on television, particularly on television, it's the bad guys who start the fight. And the good guys who answer it are usually not just civilians, but they're Batman or Power Rangers or some, or police or some group in society that is meant to protect society. And in the end of the program, the people who started the fight lose. And so you could argue, I'm not saying this is right, but you could argue that that what children learn is, I better not start a fight because I'm going to lose. I'm not saying that's the right explanation, but it's a possible explanation.
If I could just add one thing to that. You know, I think it's difficult to extrapolate from the kind of experience that you discussed, because my experience tells me that the sun moves around the earth. I stand here and I look up and the sun moves across the sky. Science tells me that's not true. And that's because, you know, investigation other than just my own experience is important to resolve those matters. I think the same is true here, and I go back and say the same thing. It makes sense to read the studies, read the research.
Stephen Balcom up here.
Stephen Balcom with the Family Online Safety Institute. Not to beat up on you, Jonathan, but I just wanted to play devil's advocate for a second. I am familiar with Dr. Donald Roberts' work at Stanford University, and his view was the copycat behavior of violence after watching television was one and probably the least of the two other reactions that he identified. And the first was the second was a sense of foreboding. You know, the world is a scary place, and I feel like I could be a victim. I've got to stay indoors. I'm afraid. And the third, which he thought was most prevalent and actually probably the most pervasive and therefore the most dangerous, was a kind of desensitization to violence, a kind of a so what? You know, hey. So there's a loss of empathy, there's a loss of compassion for fellow man, all that kind of stuff. Could you comment on that?
Well, sure. The notion of a scary world, which George Gerbner started a long time ago, has actually not stood up. There's no evidence that children who watch a lot of violent television think the world is scarier than those who watch less. If they watch the news, they might think that. But not fictional. I mean, you know, you don't have to watch Arthur to think the world is dangerous. Arthur, the aardvark never gets hurt, you know, but other people do in the real world. So, you know, I don't think you need television to think the world is scary. But in fact, the evidence, George Gerbner did a fair amount of research and argued for this, but I think virtually everyone now agrees that that is not the case. Maybe not everyone. The notion of desensitization goes way back, and it's the suggestion is, well, you see so much violence, and then it doesn't matter anymore. There really is no evidence for that. But admittedly, very few studies even look at it. It's very hard to look at. There were a couple of studies that had a slight suggestion that people, kids who saw a violent a fight, took 3 seconds or 4 seconds longer to call an adult when some real people were fighting. Well, you know, that may be true, but that didn't replicate. There are some studies that look at it in a larger scale. Belson did a huge study in England where he looked at many 700, 800 teenagers and looked at their exposure to media violence and their desensitization. And they were not less sensitive and not less concerned. I think what happens is, and maybe this is why people keep saying this, if you watch a lot of television violence or movie violence or any kind of violence, you do get desensitized to television violence or movie violence. That is, every program, what was shocking 20 years ago is nothing these days. And so there is what we call more habituation. It's like with anything else, you get used to it. And like the so-called dirty words, when we first heard them on television, you know, F's and S and those things, unbelievable. Well, now you do hear them on television, and you hear them in the movies, and it's, well, you know, it's not as big a shock as them. You get used to it. But that's very different from the violence part of it. It's very different from saying, well, I've seen a lot of violence. I've seen 8,000 murders this year. And you go outside, and there's a murder. You know, oh, that was nothing. I've seen 8,001 murders now, you know. There's no evidence that kids who have been exposed to television, or that the generation that was raised on zillions of murders and zillions of fights, are less concerned about violence. I mean, I make the case that the first really anti-war generation in recent years, I mean, there was an anti-war generation first of all also, but the Vietnam War generation was the first generation that was raised on television. I mean, not everyone was against the war, but they were pretty anti-war. And this is not science. This is anecdote, because you can't conclude too much from that. But I can say that the desensitization step is not there. Not, it's there even less than the aggression, if that's possible.
There's a question back here. Please state your name.
Al Milliken, affiliated with Washington Independent Writers. Do any of you know of research being done outside of the United States in America? I was curious what we know about televised violence and its impact in other cultures and countries. For example, since Al Jazeera newscasts show more graphic details, particularly of after effects of violence, do we have any way of drawing comparisons or knowing what researchers are saying in other parts of the world?
I don't want to monopolize this, but I guess that is a question for me. Well, and let's distinguish between coverage of real violence and war scenes and that kind of stuff. I don't know what the effect of that is, but there have been studies in other countries. There was a study done, a cross-national study in six countries, the United States, and then four European countries and Israel, and that got very disappointing results for those who believe in the negative effect of violence. In fact, the Dutch psychologists who probably did the most careful job, or maybe that's a value judgment, concluded that there wasn't a shred of evidence that television violence had any effect on aggression. And they stated that so clearly and so baldly that they weren't allowed to publish their chapter in the book that covered this, because the true believers thought they were being a little too straight, perhaps. The answer really is we don't know much, but you can say that Japan traditionally has had the most violent television that anyone, fictionalized television that we are familiar with, and they have an infinitesimal crime rate even compared to nowadays in the United States. So it's hard to tell.
The question over here in this corner. Please wait for the microphone.
I just wanted to know, a BOGO, did you say BOGO doll? What was the BOGO
yes,
doll?
Yes, BOBO doll.
Oh, BOBO.
BOBO, B-O-B-O. That's what you wanted to know?
Did I Google that?
Yeah.
They're actually called BOZO with a Z in England. It's the same doll.
Okay, we have a microphone already here. I'm sorry. Wait for that microphone.
Hi, my name is Eli Lee. I'm with Concerned Women for America. Good afternoon. I wanted to bring the discussion back to cable choice, if I could. Mr. Geller and Ms. Brock talked about the V-chip and its use as a parental tool, and we feel as an organization that cable choice is the same idea, putting just another tool at parents' disposal for the regulation of what comes into their home and also what they pay for. It's really just a free market solution, and having a voice as an active consumer of which shows you want your kids to watch and which channels you want to pay for. And CWA actually did a Worthland poll in 2004, and 80% of our 1,000 respondents believe that cable choice was a fair option in programming, even if they said that they wouldn't pay for the cable choice programming themselves. So I was wondering if you guys had any comments on that.
And a la carte regulation, what she's talking about is the idea of channel by channel, breaking up the channels, requiring that they be sold individually, FCC requiring.
I'd love to have a la carte, because I only watch a very few channels, and it would be a bargain. And I understand Consumers Union and the other push to have it. If you look at it strictly as a regulatory matter, there are arguments on both sides of it. The cable industry has a very cogent argument that they have developed all these channels. You get this enormous diversity of 90, 100, because they have not done a la carte, but put them all together. That if you have Black Entertainment standing alone and Home and Garden and Food Channel and so on, they won't make it. I don't know. That's a marketplace argument that I'm not in position to evaluate, and it is one that Senator McCain and others have brought up. Leave aside that. It's an entirely different issue. I've often wondered why somebody doesn't, incidentally, try to offer just a few channels. The telcos have come in. The telcos have come in, and they're offering the whole amount. Broadcast, one last thing. Because it has 19.4 megabits per second, some broadcasters thought of offering just about 20 channels on a very cheap basis, but subscription pay TV on maybe about 12 megabits per second. Never came off. What I'm saying is there's been no marketplace solution here the way there has in Canada and in Hong Kong and other places. When you look at it in terms of the argument we're having today, that it's a solution to the patently offensive, I don't see that at all. I don't see why it would be in any way. Everybody takes the broadcast channels and then takes whatever else they want, five or six. The broadcast channels have violence on it, and it wouldn't touch them. I mentioned the History Channel. You wouldn't want to eliminate that. You just want to see it at times. I don't see at all why it's being advanced as a solution. And the final thing I'd say to it is you run in again to the Playboy decision. If you have a less restrictive way of proceeding, namely that the cable subscriber can opt out or can use the set-top box or whatever, then you can't go around turning the cable industry upside down for that purpose. That purpose, namely to get at excessive violence, however you define it, can be accomplished through this less restrictive manner. So I think it's a red herring by the chairman entirely. He's been proposing it, Chairman Martin, several times. And it may or may not be something to be done on the merits of price regulation, but it has nothing to do with violence.
Robin or Bob, you want to comment?
Yeah, I was going to say, getting back to your point of consumerism, and I wanted to talk about, we are, as consumers, we all have an incredible power, bigger than the government and bigger than anything else. We have the power to demand that programming be changed. We have the power to demand that there be less violence. I mean, that there be less offensive, quote-unquote offensive programming. So one of the most perfect recent examples is what happened to Don Imus. It was not a First Amendment issue. It was a business issue. It was a show business issue where consumers spoke, sponsors pulled, and the show was canceled. And that was a perfect example of consumers and citizens using their power to change programming.
Mm-hmm. Bob, you want to think on a la carte?
I would just add that it is a proposed solution that is remarkably unsuited to the issue of the violence report. I was struck that it was added to the report because it really has little or nothing to do with the issue of televised violence. But it has been a favored proposal by the chairman. With respect to the marketplace issue, as Henry mentioned, the GAO has studied the matter twice and has concluded that there would be less diversity on cable channels if it existed. But I would dispute your characterization of it in the question as a marketplace solution. It's a marketplace solution only if the marketplace adopts it on its own. It's not a marketplace solution if the government mandates it. And as the proposals for a la carte have evolved, starting as a method with Senator McCain's proposals for it, for some kind of price regulation and become a proposal in favor of some kind of content regulation, any justification that policymakers would use to get to an a la carte mandate, if they were to enact it as an FCC rule or to legislate, would be expressly content-based and would face very high constitutional hurdles based on that justification. But beyond that, it's really unsuited to violence because violence is a program-by-program or scene-by-scene issue. It's not a network-by-network issue. And I think Commissioner Adelstein really summed that up in his separate statement in the violence report, where he wrote that the History Channel, for example, sometimes broadcasts war scenes far too violent for young children, that dropping it would deprive them of the valuable educational content that it provides. TV violence is not viewed in the record as a channel-by-channel problem, and he concludes, I suppose a parent could choose to receive only home and garden television and the food channel to avoid violent programming, since there are so few other channels devoid of violence, but I do not see how that helps parents much.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just add one other thing, that there have been quite a few filings by various family groups and various types of minority groups and others who provide minority-based, female-oriented, family-friendly programming on cable and satellite television. And I cannot find one that supports the idea of a la carte as giving them a greater platform. In fact, they all agree that it would destroy the diversity, the wonderful 500-channel diversity of programming we have, which includes all of that great family-friendly fare. We have time for just one last question before we hit the end of the hour. Jonathan May?
Hi, question for any or all the panelists, just to talk about the legislative outlook action on the FCC report.
Anyone on that one? We should note, we haven't noted to start, that there was a hearing scheduled for yesterday, of course, that has now been rescheduled for, I believe, June 26th, and so there is action pending there, and of course, legislation likely to be introduced before then. And legislation was introduced last session by Senator Rockefeller, S-616, which I have a paper over there if you'd like to read my analysis of. But does anybody have any comments about how this is likely to play out?
I've already indicated that if you get it to the floor, nobody is going to vote against getting rid of excessive violence. It'll be just like the indecent episode, and I would suspect it'll go through. If it does reach the floor, if it is knocked off, it will be knocked off in committee because some people start looking at the Supreme Court decisions like Playboy and others and decide that this is a trip we shouldn't take, particularly as we move toward digital and toward the Internet being so important and software solutions. But that's my prediction. You get it on the floor, they'll vote for it.
Anyone else on that one?
I was just going to say that one of the things that the Creative Coalition is doing with Capitol Hill and with a group called Safety for Kids is that we are holding a summit on media literacy. It'll be on June 5th here on Capitol Hill. We have a lot of participation from both sides of the aisle of Congress. And I think it's because, you know what, I don't think either side of the aisle want to legislate what is violent and what is not, what is appropriate and what is not. I think everyone is in agreement, whether it's policymakers, the providers of entertainment. We are in a situation where we do need guidelines, and we do need to be educated, and we need to learn how to use the guidelines. But I think also that the last resort would be to have some type of government intervention telling us what is appropriate and what is not. Okay.
Well, thank you.
There's one thing. I think what they may get around it is to vote for a study. A study doesn't do anything but shows that they're concerned.
Yeah. Well, that's going to have to be the last word. I encourage you all to visit the PFF.org website if you'd like more material on this or an archived audio tape of this event. And please join me in welcoming our wonderful panelists today.